Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio, our opportunity to learn about the world of technology from one another and from a blind and partially sighted perspective. Welcome in. I'm your host, Dave Williams. If you'd like to contact the programme, if you've got any ideas, suggestions, thoughts, feedback, all of that, you can email to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Voice notes and traditional emails, all very welcome. Coming up this week on Tech Talk, RNIB education specialist Jane Sharp will be telling us about the role of technology in the classroom. David Hogg is taking a look at the BL glasses, and we'll be hearing from a Tech Talk listener who's got some smart tech in some very unusual places. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Tasneem Arshad, Callum Stoneman. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you. Hello.
Sounds like you're recovering there, Tasneem.
I am definitely recovering from a virus, thankfully not COVID, but getting there slowly.
Any technology on your radar?
Well, I was in a well-known electrical store a couple of weeks ago, and I was eyeing up the multiple number of Fitbits, which I thoroughly liked, but I know that they're not as accessible as some of the smartwatches because they don't really have the kind of text-to-speech, but I'm kind of intrigued as to where Fitbit are up to with that, actually. So I wondered if anybody knew anything about that.
How about you, Callum? What's on your mind?
I'm just looking forward to hearing more about these BL glasses. This seems to be a common thing that's coming up lately. Smart glasses seem to finally be, I don't know about taking off, but they seem to be making a bit of a comeback. It seems to be like a second attempt. So let's see what these have got to offer.
Wearable tech, very much a theme at the moment. Let us know, do you wear any tech? Have you got a Fitbit or maybe some other kind of fitness tracker? And how about glasses? Do you use any kind of smart glasses? Let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Well, Callum, Tasneem, stick around. It's Tech Talk. Blind and partially sighted people of a certain vintage may remember when your school got their first talking computer. I remember we had four IBM PC compatible machines, those big beige boxes that used to sit on desktops delivered to my school. Oh, probably about 35 years ago now, dare I say it. Well, things have moved on quite a bit since then. And of course, technology is all around us. And it's massively important that blind and partially sighted students can get the most from technology and use technology to support with education. And here to help us get our heads round this subject is education specialist and qualified teacher of the visually impaired, Jane Sharp. Hello, Jane. Welcome to RNIB Connect Radio. Can you just describe for us a little bit about your role with RNIB?
Yeah, hello, Dave. Yeah, and thanks for inviting me on today. It's a real privilege to be on a programme that I listen to all the time. So I joined RNIB in September. As part of the education team, and the education team is part of the wider children, young people and families team. So the role's very varied, which I love. One of the things that I do is develop resources and training for vision impairment education professionals. So we run an online virtual sessions every year, a whole programme of that, and we have resources that we put up on the website. I answer education queries from families and from professionals. They're not all on technology, unfortunately for me, but a lot of them are. So, for example, I'll get professionals ringing up and they maybe want to talk through what the options might be for a younger learner. You know, what technology could they be introducing them to? They might want to talk about options for a learner that's coming up to leaving school and moving to further education. You know, should they be changing what they're using? Would it be good to introduce them to something new for the next stage in their education? I get families asking, had one fairly recently where their son was getting their first smartphone and they were wondering where they could get training for them. you know, so that they could use it because they were a speech user. So very varied. And also, I sometimes get the opportunity to go to events and meetings, and that means that I can let people know more about the services that our education team offer, but also to raise the profile of a new development in the sector, which is the curriculum framework. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that later.
We certainly will. And you, of course, have substantial experience working with blind and partially sighted students, helping them to get to grips with their technology so that they can be independent and make the most of all the opportunities that lie ahead. But you've got quite the collection of hats, Jane, because you're also chair of VUE, the Visually Impaired Education Workforce. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's just my turn at the moment, sitting in chair for VUE. So the Professional Association for the Vision Impairment Education Workforce is made up mainly of QTVIs and teaching assistants, but any professionals working with children, young people with vision impairment. And because vision impairment is low incidence in children, it's quite a small workforce but spread out across the country. So you find that some people are actually working alone in their school. There's nobody else in the school with specialism in vision impairment. Some QTVIs are the only one in their whole authority, so they don't have easy access always to experienced colleagues for training. I mean, I was really lucky that I started off in a resource base, and the teacher in charge of the resource base at that time was highly experienced. So I learnt loads off him and the rest of the team in there. But not everybody is as lucky. They don't always start in the same situation. And of course, there's a lot of peer support if you're working within a big team, but anybody working on their own doesn't have that. So VUE really aims to fill that gap. It provides specialist training, and we often do that with partner organisations such as RNIB. But we also develop a community so that members can share the best practice and they can support each other. And I think the other important thing that VUE does, it gives a voice to its members at a national level. And a recent example of that was the Send Review Green Paper last year. And we responded to that on behalf of members and pointed out that specialist education professionals working with children and young people with sensory impairment were hardly mentioned in the document. And that was a really important point to raise. And because VUE has a national profile, we were able to make that point with other organisations which also have a national profile, and that just sends a stronger message to the Department of Education.
Now, we heard last year about the VI curriculum framework. What is it and why is it important?
Yeah, this is a super exciting development. It's not something that I ever thought I would see happen in my time, you know, working in this field. But the curriculum framework for children and young people with vision impairment, there's a load of buzz around it at the moment. In a recent Freedom of Information survey, 89% of local authority VI services said they were aware of it, and it's not even a year since it was launched. So it's a massive project. There's many organisations in the sector that have come together to produce this. And what it does, it sets out the specialist skills that a child or young person with vision impairment might need to learn, because they're all different, in order to access the mainstream curriculum and prepare for life after education. So their specialist skills like Braille, some students will need to learn Braille, or maybe how to use magnification or speech on a computer, skills for safe, independent travel, things like that. And before the curriculum framework, there was nothing like this in the UK. VI is very low incidence, as I've said, and a lot of our learners are in mainstream schools and colleges. So we're aware that mainstream staff would not necessarily know what skills could be taught to enable their learners to access the lessons more independently. And parents, if they don't know, parents of other children with vision impairment might not know either. They might not know what to be asking schools to put in place. But having this framework means that everybody can look at it, everybody can see what specialist input is available, and then everybody can sit down together and work together and put the right support in place. So it's kind of a roadmap, you know, everybody looking at it together. They know the destination. This is as independent as possible, an adult thriving, and they've got a map of how to get there so they can plan the progression over time. We know that there are going to be different people using this document. We want to try and bring everybody together. So the main sort of document is out at the moment, that came out last May, but we're producing at the moment a parent guide to make it a bit more targeted at parents, you know, how they could use it for teacher meetings and things like that. And we're also bringing out a young person's guide, and the parent guide has been, parents have been involved in doing that with us, and the young person's guide is going to be very much designed with young people and developed with them so that they can own the curriculum framework for themselves. And we're thinking maybe they're going to come up with ideas like having it as a TikTok video or something rather than a paper document, which, you know, if that works for them and gets them involved in using it, that's brilliant. One of the underlying principles of the curriculum framework is to develop independence. And the idea is that that will be developed through learning skills. So if I give you an example, a very young learner might have large print books given to them by their TA in school. But as they get older, they might be taught to use an e-reader so that they can personalise the settings for themselves. And then when they're older, they can access books for themselves. Which brings me on to another part of the curriculum framework project, which is to make resources more widely available to both professionals and students. So there's an associated resource hub, which is hosted on RNIB Bookshare. And in fact, just recently, you might have heard that they announced that the Bookshare catalogue has passed 1 million resources. So we can see that a learner who can use an e-reader for themselves independently can choose from an incredible number of accessible books, not just from Bookshare, but from commercial suppliers as well. Basically, a whole world of books has opened up to them. And I think that just really encapsulates what the curriculum framework is aiming to do.
When it comes to technology, and I'm thinking particularly of specialist technology, what do you think some of the challenges are around procurement and training on that technology for blind and partially sighted students?
Yeah, there are challenges, and I would say the two main factors are probably funding, as you'd expect, and the availability of specialist teaching. So each individual needs a bespoke technology solution. The same devices used in the same way are not going to work for everybody. So bespoke solutions would require bespoke teaching, and that means that the specialist teachers, generally QTVIs or trained up TAs, need to have enough contact time to deliver a programme of that specialist teaching. And they also need staff, because it's the mainstream staff that are supporting the student with that equipment day in and day out, so they need to be confident with it as well. And the other thing is specialist staff themselves need to access training on specialist devices because they develop all the time. Technology is always moving on, and so they have to have availability and time for training for themselves. So that's a factor. Funding, well, a lot of funding has been cut from services, so not so many now have their kind of stock of devices. And this is a problem when the specialist staff are trying to keep up with their own skills and knowing what the new developments are. If services have a range of devices available, then they can try those different devices and different solutions with different learners to find out what they need before the school makes a purchase, because funding tends to go to schools these days. So, you know, that's an issue, the lack of funding for services. But equally, you can get issues with funding for technology for learners. And I guess this is more around the fact that the ideal solution is often a package of technology, not just one device. and needs can change over time. And because some of the equipment is expensive, then the funder, who doesn't necessarily see the student on a daily basis, they just see it on a piece of paper and it seems really expensive. So sometimes it can be difficult to get that funding. In terms of learning, I think there's a massive opportunity if the technology at school and the technology at home are similar. It's a great opportunity for the student to develop mastery, because using their technology for fun and for leisure is a massive motivator. So it can be a challenge sometimes when that isn't the case, when the technology in school is different to what's been, probably not a challenge so much as just, in my opinion, a missed opportunity.
There are lots of challenges and lots of barriers and lots of things that can get in the way of students acquiring the equipment they need and the appropriate training, and also challenges for some of those specialist staff keeping skills up to date. One of the things I've heard occasionally as well is that IT teams sometimes cite system security as a reason for not making something accessible or not allowing a device on a school network. Is that something you've encountered? How aware are school IT teams of the requirements of their blind and partially sighted students?
No, absolutely. This is something that I have come across, and I suppose it's fairly common as an initial response if a school hasn't had a student with vision impairment before. It can be something that you hear quite early on when you're working with them. But what I have found is that in a lot of schools, once you've spoken to the IT person, and in a primary school it can just be one person, it's normally a team in secondary. But once you've sat down and spoken with somebody, a lot of the IT people, they actually get quite excited and quite interested, because I suppose they see it as something different to mending printers or sorting people out with their passwords. They're like, oh, here's a little challenge. You know, how can I get this up and running? And I found some fantastic people in schools coming up with screen mirroring solutions and, like you say, connecting to the school network. And another thing I think as well that really helps in these situations, if you can invite one of the IT team to come and meet the student and look at their equipment and how they're using it, then suddenly the student becomes a real person that they want to help, rather than just a number on a job sheet. But there will be the odd school where, you know, that those sort of strategies don't really work, or the you haven't got the people in place that you would hope for on the IT team. Sometimes it's just a misunderstanding, and I think the QTVI is really important here in talking to the IT team directly if possible. You know, sometimes you might be, because as QTVIs we know that some specialist devices just, you know, they can't go on the school network with access to the school drives. We know that because they're working on a different operating system. But we might just be asking for internet access, you know, so that the student can, do things a little bit differently. Maybe use a shared drive with their teacher, like Google Drive or something, that you can get in a browser, rather than trying to get onto the school network. And if you explain that, sometimes they're like, oh, right, OK, yeah, we can do that. Some of them have a bring-your-own-device Wi-Fi, so they can use that. So sometimes you can work it out if you can iron out any misunderstandings. But I suppose the thing you've got in your back pocket always, which you try not to bring out unless you really need it, is you mentioned that phrase, it's a reasonable adjustment for this student to be put, you know, to have internet access in school, and you're backed up in that by the Equality Act. So very, very occasionally I have had to just mention those words, and surprisingly things seem to move quite quickly when you get to that point. So challenges, yes, but you can normally get around them.
So as you know, Jane, I'm a blind dad to a sighted child. That's not his fault. And I'm interested to know, what can sighted parents of blind children do to help when it comes to advocating for and you know, upskilling around the whole area of technology for their students?
Yeah, I think that you can understand why that would be difficult for sighted parents if they don't know what to ask for, really. And I think this is where the curriculum framework really comes into its own. Area 8 technology and Area 7 access and information, I think, are very helpful to prompt discussions between the family and the school and the QTVI. You can get them talking about what programmes have we got in place this year to develop the students' skills in these areas. What are we going to need next year? Is the current equipment still appropriate? And then the curriculum framework encourages you to look to the future. So they'll be asking questions like, what's needed at the next stage? What's going to be needed in their new... Maybe they're going to college, or maybe they're going to secondary school from primary, or maybe they're approaching exams. So I think that helps to kind of focus in on these discussions and at least ask the questions. And then hopefully the QTVI, with their specialist knowledge, will be able to come up with some ideas of what's needed. I think another thing for sighted parents to be sort of looking out for is if schools seem to be over relying on a one-to-one to provide access to lessons, because this can seem on the surface of it like a strategy that's providing a good level of access. But I think in those cases, I think they can ask the QTVI, you know, are there any technology solutions that can promote a bit more independence? So if the adult's reading what the teacher's putting on the board, you know, maybe they can look at screen mirroring options. Or if the adult's using a specialist music composition piece of software, in inverted commas, with the child, you know, is there anything that the child can use on their own? So I think it's asking those questions. And also, if the child's using technology at home, which they will be, because all children do, I think it's a good conversation to have with the QTVI, you know, say they're finding something difficult at home or whatever, you know, could the QTVI include that in their lessons in school? Because that'll only help them to develop their skills. And if they're better at using their technology generally because they're using it at home and school, maybe it's for leisure things at home, but it's still developing their skills. And then they're just going to be much more independent at school, and that can open doors as well to using more powerful devices with more specialist features. So, yeah, I think those kind of things to bear in mind.
We'll hear more from RNIB education specialist Jane Sharp a little bit later on. Panasonic recently announced a partnership with BL, an assistive technology company from Barcelona, to use their technology in some new prototype smart glasses. RNIB Connect Radio's David Hogg has been finding out more.
I'm now joined by Jeremy Puch, co-founder and CEO of BL Glasses, who have recently announced a partnership with Panasonic. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for your interest in our company.
First of all, what do the BL smart glasses do?
Well, our glasses, we call them BL smart gaze. They are designed to solve the mobility issues of the people with low vision and increase their mobility. Mobility issues are the worst consequence of low vision, causing falls, injuries, dependency, and isolation. And it happens the most when there is a peripheral vision loss, which is normally called tunnel vision, like happens in glaucoma or retinitis, or even in some effects of strokes. These people used to run into obstacles or other mobility risk that may be out of their visual field. And what our glasses do is that we use 3D vision and AI to understand the scene. Then we are able to detect any kind of obstacles, steps, holes, bumps, branches, any kind of mobility risk. And then we use mixed reality to adapt this information to the remaining vision of the patient. More specifically, we use graphical signs adapted to the remaining vision of the patients, like arrows or other kind of graphical signs, and we can place these graphical signs within the visual field of the patient, so the patients can realize of all this possible risk for their mobility, so they can move around safely.
Going back now to the beginning of the company, How did you guys start? I've got quite an interesting origin story, especially to your name.
The glasses actually called after my son, Biel. My son, he's now 10 years old. And when he was 2 years old, we realized that something was wrong with him because it took a long time for him to start walking. And even when he started walking, he was suffering falls and injuries all the time. And he had a very weighted weight for descending stairs. And so after visiting many doctors, we finally realized that the problem was with his eyes, and he has a congenital condition that caused him low vision. And in his case, he has this peripheral vision loss. And when we were told that in his case, this condition will not get worse, but will not improve. So there was nothing to do. And my wife and I, well, she's a medical doctor, I'm an engineer, and we tried to find something, let's say, not to cure him, because we knew that there was no way for solving his medical problems, but at least to improve this his quality of life. And I have a background working in virtual reality for educational purposes and so on. And then the idea was basically to use mixed reality, which is a combination of virtual reality and augmented reality, to adapt reality to his remaining vision. So as we cannot improve his eyes, to adapt the world to his eyes. And this is more or less the story of the way we started this.
And that leads us to the present day, where recently in January, you announced a partnership with Panasonic that was announced at CES. So can you tell us a bit about this partnership, how it came about, and what you're planning to do together?
Well, we have been working with Panasonic for more than 1 year. Panasonic has one of the best available virtual reality technologies that is available in the market. And they want this technology to be used for other purposes, but for gaming, for purposes for health or social or other industrial applications. But they were especially interested in our project as a way to use this technology to help people. And this is part of the strategy of Panasonic as a group. During this collaboration, what we tried, what we have been working in, it was to integrate our technology with their virtual reality technology. And what we were able to present in the CES in Las Vegas was the first functional prototype, fully functional version of Biel Smart Gaze, integrating the Panasonic 5.2 key display technology. So it's right now I can say for sure that we have the best display technology of all the glasses for low vision that could be available in the market. And we are combining both technologies, the part of the display from Panasonic and all the part related to scene understanding from Biel glasses.
Fantastic stuff. You must be really excited about that. What's coming up for the next couple of months and also throughout the rest of 2023? And also, where can our listeners find out more about you?
What we are working right now, mostly here in, we are based in Barcelona, and we are running now some pilot projects. We started with three, half-size cities here in around Barcelona, and now we have a major pilot that we are starting right now. And during the year, we will be carrying this pilot project in Barcelona in collaboration with the Barcelona City Council in order to use our technology, improve the accessibility of the public areas of the city for the people with low vision. You were asking also where you can find more information about us. You can look at our website for sure. It's blglasses.com. It's B-I-E-L. And you can also send an email to info@blglasses.com. And then you will go to our website where you will find information about our product and technology and so on. And about our collaboration with Panasonic, you can also, the best thing is to Google BL glasses and Panasonic, and you will find a lot of articles and so on about this collaboration.
Excellent stuff. Well, Jaume Puig, the co-founder and CEO of BL Glasses, thanks so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to explain our project and technology to your listeners. Thank you very much.
return now to Dave's conversation with RNIB education specialist Jane Sharp.
Many VI students are very keen to appear as, quotes, normal, whatever that is, as normal as possible by only using mainstream devices. And indeed, many mainstream devices have, you know, fantastic accessibility options and tools built in. But sometimes it's actually a specialist device that offers the greatest efficiency and productivity. How do we make the case for specialist devices?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many options, aren't there? I think one thing that my students has taught me over the years, and I was working in schools for 19 years, is that the best solution is the one that they will use. And sometimes I can think that something is the best solution for a student, but if they don't buy into that, if they're not buying into that at that time, then I'm wrong, it's not the best solution. I think the choices need to be student-led. So I had a student a few years ago, and he had some sight. He had used a bit of Braille. He was quite a mix-and-match student, but he was, you know, he really liked the iPad. The school had iPads, and I thought, OK, right, I think the student's really gonna like the iPad. But I showed, and I think this is important, to show the students all the options. So I showed him, we looked at Windows computer, we also looked at a Braille note taker, we looked at some different ways to use the iPad. And very surprisingly to me, the Braille note taker turned out to be his favoured device. And I've had that, you know, the other way around as well, where I've thought that the Braille note taker was a good solution and they've gone with something different. But I think the important thing is to give them the options, show them the different tools and the different ways they can be used. What works in one situation might not be their choice for another situation. And then basically, as far as you can, go with their preference. And I think patience is a good thing as well. You know, sometimes students come round to things later on. And I think it's just important that you maybe keep reminding them of the what the options are as they go on, because they might be getting frustrated with something on their chosen, you know, with their chosen way of working. You can go, oh yeah, do you remember we looked at this and you could use this, and they might buy into it later on. So I think, yeah, just keep the options open all the time and keep reminding them and letting them know of improvements as well, and just letting them lead on the choice. And they will quite often choose specialist tools because they turn out to be, you know, they realise as they mature that the efficiency outweighs any sort of advantage from looking like you're using a normal device. But sometimes you need to wait for them to mature into that mindset.
Technical subjects such as science and technology and engineering and mathematical subjects, maybe even music actually, can pose particular challenges for blind and partially sighted students. Have you got any examples of solutions, you know, the sorts of things that you would expect a student wanting to study, take a subject like design technology, you know, what would you expect a blind or a partially sighted student to kind of have in their toolbox?
Yeah, you're right. The STEM subjects and music as well do throw up probably more challenges than some of the other subjects. The challenges can be kind of wide ones, like use of calculators, or they could be subject specific around, you know, particular software that isn't very accessible. You know, things like Scratch is widely used in mainstream schools for coding. SketchUp is another one used for, as you mentioned, design technology. And I think if the student has got, you know, a good sort of basic level of use of accessibility tools on mainstream devices, whether that's a Mac or Windows PC or tablet, that can be a real help. So for example, if a student is struggling to access a standard calculator, Windows PCs have got a brilliant calculator built in. It's not great visually, so if your student's got quite poor vision, it's not great, but it works really well with the screen reader and keyboard shortcuts. So if they've already got those basic skills, then they've got access to a good calculator straight away at really no extra cost, because most schools have laptops, you know, lying around.
And iOS as well, Jane. If you put the iOS device into Landscape, you actually get a scientific calculator, which a lot of people don't realise.
That is a great tip. Thank you. I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you get your calculator up on your iPhone or whatever, and then you turn it sort of into Landscape, and then all these extra buttons appear. It's magic.
That is brilliant. Yeah, you mentioned DT, and I do have a student. I mean, design technology is definitely not my subject, but there was a student that sort of came to my attention. It wasn't on my caseload, but I was asked to go and see him because he was doing DT and the class had started using SketchUp, and he did have some vision. He could see the canvas in the middle of the screen in order to sort of draw things, but he couldn't see the tools down the left and right hand sides. So my first instinct with this type of thing is, because ideally you want the student to have access to the specialist teaching from their subject teacher and be able to do, as far as possible, the same projects as everybody else in the class. So I usually try mainstream solutions first. And with this student, I had a look at the accessibility features on Windows computer, the Windows magnifier, and some of the speech tools on there, but that didn't work well enough. But we found with a Mac, we had an old Mac from a student who did music technology at college, and we found with the hover text tool and the speak item under pointer, you know, he could access that. And if he'd have been able to use those tools, you know, already, then we would have had him straight back in class working along with everybody else very, very quickly. So I think having those mainstream tools, mastery over those, is really helpful. But equally, being competent using third-party magnification or a screen reader can be really helpful, because sometimes the solution might be actually to use some different software. So I had a student doing computer science a few years ago, and the class were using a kind of a program where you just dragged and dropped blocks of code, which he couldn't access at all because he had no vision. So what we did instead was we used Python in Notepad++ on his computer. But because he was very, very competent using NVDA, we just switched straight onto that, and he was able to do the entire course, but just using slightly different methods. So I suppose, as well as having their own skills in the toolkit, having the QTVI and a solution-focused subject teacher, they're really good to have in the toolkit as well, so that they can work together on finding different ways to achieve the same learning outcomes.
And of course, sometimes the solution might be sort of a very low-tech one and might not be technology at all. I remember making graphs with tactile graph paper and elastic bands and pins and things like that. So it doesn't always have to have software and buttons and batteries and all of that.
No, we did flow charts with little cutout arrows and blue tacking them on, and different shaped boxes for the different types of operations. So yeah, low tech is always good to have a new toolkit too.
What else can parents, teachers, and maybe even VI organisations do to prepare our young people for using technology in higher education and even the workplace?
Yeah, I think prepare is the key word in that. Just plan ahead. I think have the expectation that a young person will be able to use a suite of technology, not just one device, and that will most likely consist of both specialist and mainstream tools, and that gives them the opportunity to choose the best tool for each individual job. I think it's important that we provide opportunities for young people to try out different tools in advance of you know, going on to university or work, so they know what works for them. I mean, you know, how would they know if a Windows computer or an iPhone, JAWS or Braille display or Zoom text was going to be a game changer for them if they've never had the chance to try them? And I think another important thing is, you know, to help them develop their self advocacy skills, so they know when to ask for adjustments and they can explain what they need and why. I had a student who went on to university, and she asked me to go to a DSA assessment with her, and they were explaining that all the standard offer is a Windows computer and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But she'd used a Mac because she was doing music technology at college. So, you know, we just explained that actually it was unreasonable to expect her in a new situation, new university, doing a new course, living on her own for the first time. It was actually unreasonable to expect her to learn to use a whole new type of technology. So just knowing that it's okay to ask for these things and to explain to people, I think that's really useful. And another example is a student that had, again, at university, I mean, she was very good at self-advocating, but they were, again, asking her to start using a Windows computer to access their virtual learning environment. And up until then, they'd been emailing her the assignments. And, you know, she was getting quite upset about having all this additional work, but we chatted and she just needed the confidence to know that actually she was okay to go back to them and say, actually, it's a reasonable adjustment for me, for you to continue emailing me the assignments. I don't need to learn to use the technology that you're saying just to access your environment. So I think really empowering them and encouraging them to self-advocate. And I think that brings us back to the curriculum framework, because Area 11 focuses on preparation for adulthood, and so that means that, you know, people hopefully who are using it in their planning, the team around the young person, they don't get distracted by sort of very current concerns like access to exams or something, but they're always considering the bigger picture, the future, and hopefully putting things in place early. So I think it's all down to preparation, and we can help young people to prepare.
Jane, I know you're a super busy lady. Thank you so much for your generosity in both time and expertise. Where can listeners learn more about education services from RNIB?
Yeah, it's really easy, and we'd be really happy to hear from people who want to ask us or talk to us about education. So they can ring the RNIB helpline, or they can email cypf@rnib.org.uk. That's cypf@rnib.org.uk.
Jane Sharp, Education Specialist and Qualified Teacher of the Visually Impaired, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
We come now to some of your listener emails. Colin has been in touch, and Colin says, I wonder if you have used the Orcam Read Smart from VisionAid. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this product. Tasneem Arshad, I think you had a demo, didn't you, a while back?
I did, of both the glasses version and also this Read Smart, which is more of a pen type handheld effectively. So yeah, for me, I think to use both of these devices, it's really helpful to have a reasonable level of vision, I would say, because you do need to sort of point at them or to see the lines on the sheet of paper to basically be able to guide the smart read. It does read everything out aloud, but of course, you know, if you can't see what you're doing with the lines of text, then it's pretty redundant, in my opinion. But what I would say is definitely try it out for yourself, see how you get on with it, have a bit of a practice with it. For me personally, or for somebody who's totally blind, I wouldn't think that it's a very useful product.
Yeah, I agree. I did have a very brief demo of it. I've had quite a long demonstration with the glasses, but that was a while ago, so I'm not going to base too much on that because it was about 3 or 4 years ago now. But the Read Smart, I had a brief play with it at Sight Village last year, and I thought I'd prefer it on the glasses, but I think I do prefer the pen version. That does seem to be a bit more forgiving, I think. But you do ideally need to at least be able to give yourself that little bit of guidance and, you know, guide it across the sheet in the right order that it needs.
Absolutely, and I think that I found that the voice is quite robotic on them as well. The good thing I do like about Orcam is the gesture-based stuff. I think they've really got that spot on, and the fact that it's offline. You don't require the internet for it, so the plus points for it, but do check it out for yourself.
Yeah, if you can get a demonstration in person, or even if you could get to borrow one and use it in your own environment and have a little bit of time with it. And a lot of companies, if you are ordering online or over the phone, they do have a grace period where if the product is not suitable for your needs, then you should be able to return it for a full refund. So do speak to the supplier about that.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Here on Tech Talk in the past, we've spoken quite a bit about smart home technology. Some of you may have smart light bulbs that you're able to control with your smart speaker. Some of us are using video doorbells, and we recently got a dishwasher that sends me a notification to my watch when the program is finished or it wants more rinse aid. Now, Emil Secker is from New Zealand and is extremely enthusiastic about smart home technology and has managed to tech everything up from his bin to his bed. Emil joins us now. Welcome to Tech Talk. Hello.
Hello, Dave. Thank you for having me.
Ah, it's our pleasure. So, why do you think that you have become so enthusiastic about smart home technology?
I've always enjoyed having machines do the mundane tasks for me, like, for example, vacuuming. Like, for example, I've got a robot vacuum that I have on a schedule.
Right, okay. And where did this start? Like, where did it come from, do you think?
So I started watching smart home content on YouTube, and that's where it kind of blossomed.
Right. So you were watching a few things online. Anyone in particular?
Smart Home Solver is a good one. Paul Hibbert, Hibbert Home Tech. He's also based in the UK. You may or may not know him.
And what was the first smart home device you purchased?
Ah, that's easy. That was my washing machine when my old one actually died.
Right. So you went straight in at the deep end. No mucking around with smart speakers and light bulbs. It was straight in with a white.
If you want to go back further, my first smart home device was two of Apple's original HomePods, but that was well before I got into the smart home game truly. But my washing machine was my first true smart home device.
Right, and what motivated you there? Why did you decide you needed a smart washing machine in your life?
Well, I saw it in the shop and looked at the price, and I knew that I'd better get notifications when my washing was done. And I like the fact that it'll notify me when to run the tub clean cycle, which otherwise, let's be honest, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
And that's probably the contributing factor to my old machine that Mum and Dad gave me dying. I had that for a total of 3 years.
And I mean, I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. You know, when my washing machine finishes, it beeps to let me know that it's finished. I mean, isn't that enough?
Well, so does mine. Mine actually sings. It's got a little sing-song tune that it does. It is enough, but I'm a nerd, and as much stuff that I can make smart, I will do it.
All right. So look, tell us about some of your more recent acquisitions, and particularly some of the more unusual stuff. I mean, you've been talking about you've got a sleep mat, and you've done something to your bin. Tell us about those.
Right. So the bin, that was, in my opinion, one of the most easiest things to do. It does involve Home Assistant, if you've used that before. So basically what I did was I created two input booleans, or in plain English, virtual switches, which do the exact same thing that physical switches do, except they're virtual inside Home Assistant. So what I then did was I got two NFC tags, stuck them on my bins, set them up to fire an event called rubbish out and recycling out, and then I made a routine that when those events are fired as the routine trigger, then to toggle the virtual switch in Home Assistant, and thus that stops the notifications coming in for putting out the recycling and the rubbish. So I guess you could say that the notifications pretty much nag me until I get up and go out and scan the tags on the bins.
Right, so just to help me understand that. So these are your outdoor bins that need to go out for collection?
Correct.
Right, so this, I mean, could you not just do a sort of a timer or something? What's it doing? Is there a sensor that detects when the bin's full or...?
No, so it's... I haven't quite gotten there yet. Have you used an NFC tag before?
So I'm aware of the technology. So this is where, you know, you bring a device close to another device and they're able to... So near field communication, just to unpack that for everyone.
So what scanning that tag does is it flicks a switch in Home Assistant and the flash stops the notifications coming to my phone from Home Assistant.
So the benefit there for you is you get notified when it's time to put the bin out.
Yeah, and I never forget because it literally nags me to do it.
Yeah, I'm usually in the shower and I hear the bin lorry rumbling down the road and thinking, now is it the green bin or is it the brown bin this week, you know? So
an add-on and Home Assistant called Local Calendar. So I've got two calendars, one for rubbish and one for recycling. So I've incorporated those in there as well.
Tell us about your sleeping arrangements, if that's not too personal a question. You've got something to sort of sense your sleep.
Ah, yes. No, that's totally fine. I live on my own. So I've set it up so that when I get out of bed, it unlocks my door. Routine has kind of been a bit iffy, so I need to look at that one. But what it does when I get into bed is it locks my doors, turns my lights off, and my heating, and it basically turns everything off and locks all my doors.
Right, so this is like a sort of a pressure sensor then, is it, when you get into bed?
Correct. It's called the Withings Sleep Analyzer.
Okay, and what other information does that give you?
So it gives me, it analyzes my sleep in the Withings app. So it says, it shows me how long I've spent in REM, light sleep, etc., etc. But let's be honest, that's not the fun part of the entire thing.
You've still got the robotic vacuum cleaner.
Yes. I'm actually on my second one. My second one, I like this one better because it's got LiDAR or light detection and ranging. So what that does is it's mapped out my entire house. So in the two-year Smart Life app, I can specify a room for it to clean. So say, for example, my kitchen after I've been cooking, and then it'll go in and do it.
Wow.
It'll go in and vacuum the floor.
Fantastic. Yeah, I've seen a couple of these. One I remember was sort of circular, a bit like a disc in shape, and it could rotate and it would take itself back to its dock, you know, when the battery was running low, that kind of thing. Does it do a good job, do you know?
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, it does miss a few bits, but it does a much better job than I could ever do myself, so I'm happy with that.
And what else have you got there, Emil?
So my second smart home edition was probably my heat pump controller. So I've stuck it on the wall next near my heat pump, and it saved my bacon in the summer when it was hot and I was coming home. So I set it on cold as I was walking up my street. And then my living room was cold when I got home, which was good.
Yes, yeah, we have a smart thermostat and we do something similar. It's been very cold in the UK in recent weeks, and so we've been able to set the heating remotely to come home to a nice warm house.
Yeah, apparently the UK doesn't have a sun, allegedly. Is that true?
Well, it does sometimes. We got 40 degrees last summer. So tell us about some of the challenges then, Emil, because we know that, like, some of this smart home stuff, it can be really fun. It can make life easier sometimes. And like you say, take away, you know, some of the tedium of doing a job that maybe a machine can do for us. But what challenges have you encountered along the way
I mean, I've definitely had to learn Home Assistant. So before I started that venture, I'd heard of Home Assistant, but never really dabbled into it. But so that I've basically now got Home Assistant running on an old PC from Mum's work, which I actually got for free. So I figured that was a good use for it. It's in a virtual machine.
Right, and have you, I mean, does it ever not work, you know? Like, does things just don't happen that you expect to happen?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. Well, just recently, because I had a 4 terabyte hard drive in that same machine, I've just migrated that into a NAS or a network attached storage device. And when I migrated Home Assistant from the hard drive to the solid state drive, all my integrations in Home Assistant worked, except my security system that died for some reason. So I had to manually set that up again in Home Assistant.
Yeah, sometimes when you change things, that's the thing, isn't it, with home automation, that it can all be going along swimmingly. I had a pair of speakers that I moved out of the office into our kitchen. And I can't get the new name to stick. I tried renaming them to Kitchen, and they still tell me that they're in the office. And I almost have given up now. I almost refer to the kitchen as the office. So sometimes getting those changes to stick when you make alterations can be a challenge. Have you encountered any accessibility issues?
Not me personally, but I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that I have enough sight that I can use my phone without voiceover. I did try the 2-year Smart Life app with voiceover just to see how it would work, and I was disappointed to find out that it's not actually voiceover accessible at all. So all of the individual buttons register as one big button. That's not a problem for me, but it could be a problem for someone who's totally reliant on voiceover.
Sure. And have you done any advocacy? Have you had any dialogue with any of the manufacturers about ways in which they could make their products and services more accessible for blind and partially sighted people?
I haven't, mainly because I haven't needed to pursue that for myself. But you raise a good point, and I might actually submit a review on the App Store.
Yeah, there was a book recently that appeared on Kindle where the publisher originally didn't want to publish it digitally, and there was a bit of advocacy to make that happen so that blind and partially sighted people could read it. I mean, they may well have had other reasons as well, and often when you make something more accessible, you improve the situation for everyone. So do let folk know if you find something that's inaccessible. Do you have any tips or hints or tricks that you'd like to share with our blind and partially sighted listeners?
Try not to replace appliances if they're still working. There are some ways that you can make, quote, dumb appliances smart, unquote, where, like, for example, with a dumb washing machine, you could use NFC tags to set timers to go off on your phone, for example.
Or even, you know, smart plug with the kettle. You know, you can switch the kettle on and
yes,
and have a smart plug to come on at a particular time.
One of the problems I've encountered with a kettle is most of them have the little switch that you flick down, and then that flicks itself back up when the water's boiled.
Ah, yes, you'd need to find the right one.
Yeah, you've got to remember to keep that flick down. But what I've got is I've got a Kogan smart kettle. It's an Australian brand. It links up with the Smart Life app. So I've got that in Home Assistant and in the Smart Life app as well. So I can integrate the kettle into my routines as well if I want to.
Now, clearly, Emil, you're steeped in this stuff. You clearly love it. But, you know, for someone who's perhaps approaching this a little bit more casually, maybe, you know, they wouldn't know what a Boolean switch is or whatever. Do you think this is still quite, you know, something for the enthusiast? Or do you think we're at a point now where actually, you know what, you can tell the A-lady, for example, you know, turn the lights on at 10 o'clock and it'll do it?
Yeah, you can totally leave Home Assistant out of it. The only one of the main reasons I set up Home Assistant was because I was frustrated on having a million apps on my phone for everything, and I wanted a clean solution where everything links into one app.
Yeah, it's true, because I have Casa for my bulbs and plugs, and then I have Home Connect for my dishwasher. You're right.
Yes, yeah, I've got some Casa bulbs and plugs, and when I eventually redo my kitchen, I'm looking at some Home Connect appliances too. I'm looking at a Samsung SmartThings fridge, a Home Connect cooktop, and a Home Connect oven. The Smart Hub fridge has also got Alexa built in.
And Emil, are there any smart home devices that don't exist that you would like to see invented?
Something that will weed my garden.
There's a challenge. Because you can get lawnmowers, can't you? You can get smart lawnmowers.
Well, yes. I don't have any lawns, so that's not something that I've looked into. But there is actually a smart home device that'll weed your garden called Turtle Weeding Robot, T-E-R-T-I-L.
Now, a lot of people are thinking about artificial intelligence and machine learning and, you know, ChatGTP and all of that at the moment. What do you think the impact of AI will be on smart home technology?
I would really like it to kind of predict what I want without me having to ask. I actually saw a post on the Accessible Smart Homes group about that kind of thing recently.
Right. So, you know, it might say, oh, well, you know, it's Thursday and on Thursday you go to band practice, so you might want your dinner earlier. So I'm going to put the oven on earlier or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, that would be fantastic.
And of course, lots of potential for it to make bad decisions as well.
Yes. Yes. Correct.
All righty. Well, just tell us about the Facebook group then. So anyone interested in smart home technology, particularly accessible smart home technology, and that's where I came across your posts, and you are certainly a font of knowledge on that group. So tell everyone about the group, where they find it, and how to get involved.
So you can find the Accessible Smart Home group on Facebook, and you just click join. I think you just answer a few basic questions and then you should be good to go. And that group is a really good way of just interacting with people and finding out different ideas.
All righty. And you're one of the moderators of that group, are you?
Yes. Yes. I'm actually one of the admins. I know him from another group, the iPhone and iPad apps for the blind and visually impaired group.
Excellent. Emil Secker from New Zealand and the Accessible Smart Home Technology Facebook group. Thanks very much.
Perfect.
Emil Secker there talking about some of the creative ways in which he is using technology to make his home smart. And, you know, after we stopped recording, Emil said to me, I have to ask you, Dave, have you found a good solution for curtains? I haven't. But Callum Stoneman, Tasneem Arshad join me now. Some really interesting stuff there. He's got a mat in his bed to monitor his sleep. The Withings smart. Matt, I think, and also he's got sensors on his bin to tell him when to put the rubbish out. Just if you could have any kind of smart device for your home, what would it be? Tasneem Arshad?
I think I would like a talking air fryer, personally. I think that would just be the business. So we could actually use the visual displays. We obviously can operate air fryers, but I would like to have the display option and to be able to use its full functionality without having to make it accessible with bump-ons and various other things. So that would be pretty cool, I think, for me.
Callum?
That's an interesting point you make there, though, to be fair, because there are smart air fryers available. There are ones that tie into Lady A and the Google Assistant and stuff, and I think on them you can set timers and ask how long it is left on it. But then they're at the premium end. And a lot of the things that you can do with this smart home tech, I don't know if there's anything that would do that, but a big part of what you can do with smart home tech is getting things that are at the more budget-friendly end and then making them smart. So it's just incredible. The mat on the bed sounds interesting. If it can sort of throw you out of your bed once you've hit snooze on your alarm 200 times, that might benefit me. That'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
I could do with that. It's all just really interesting stuff. I thought I had quite a cool setup with my smart plugs and my smart lights and the Ring doorbell and a couple of things triggered by routines, but I feel quite boring now after listening to that.
Mrs. Williams has been away recently, and I've been tasked with sorting the washing, and it is quite a tedious task with a light probe or even somebody on Be My Eyes or whatever, trying to sort out, the whites from the colours, from the other things. I'd like a device where I could just sort of chuck in all the washing regardless, and it'll sort it out into the different categories and then run those loads through on the appropriate, settings and everything. So I don't know, maybe it's a little bit far-fetched, but it doesn't hurt to dream.
An interesting snippet was on the media this morning. Apparently in 10 years' time, there's going to be about 30 or 40% of our domestic chores being completed by robots. I don't know if any of you have heard that, but found that very interesting.
Would you trust a robot to vacuum for you? I know some people who do.
I don't know. Depends how good it is at adapting to things, doesn't it? Because I know there's some people who just have these robot vacuums set on a schedule. So every couple of days at 2 p.m. or something while they're out at work, the robot hoover will just come to life and start vacuuming the room. But then how well does it do if, you've left something in the way, you've forgotten that it's going to run? Or in my case, if the dog or the cat is wandering around and they go near it, how does it handle it?
Well, and there's that urban myth, isn't there, about if your dog makes a mess, then yeah, does the robot vacuum, spread that mess far and wide? Does that happen? Has that happened? I don't want to find out.
So let's hope we don't have to test that one out.
Yeah. Well, there we are. So I'm sure this will run and run. Let us know, what do you use and what would you actively avoid? techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That brings us to the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. We do appreciate that. If you've got any thoughts or feelings or anything you'd like to share with us here, then we would love to hear from you. Voice notes, emails, all very welcome to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Do tune in next time when we will be getting a demonstration of the Emporia Talk Active phone. And we'll be catching up with the latest news from Dolphin. Tasneem Arshad, Callum Stoneman, thank you both.
Thank you. See you next week.
Thank you, and see you all soon.
And from me, Dave Williams, and the rest of the Tech Talk team, until next time, bye for now.